But without further ado, let me introduce our moderator, Robert McGrath, who's going to introduce our speaker. Bob?
So, it's my great, great pleasure to introduce once again Dahlia Lithwick. Many of you know this, but I'll quickly tell you a little bit about her. She's a senior editor at Slate Magazine, and in that capacity writes the Supreme Court dispatches and jurisprudence columns for the magazine. She also hosts the podcast Amicus. Her work regularly appears in the New York Times, in Harper's, in the New Yorker, the Washington Post, Commentary, and all sorts of other places that are worth reading. We see her often on CNN, ABC, MSNBC, and at least a while ago, we got to watch her sparring with Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart on The Daily Show. She's won a National Magazine Award for her columns on the Affordable Care Act and also online journalism awards for her legal commentary. Now, a few years ago, she did her undergraduate studies at Yale and took her law degree at Stanford. This is, I guess I said, this is her fourth appearance at Senior Statesman of Virginia, and I know we're very grateful that she manages to fit us into her incredibly busy schedule. Many of you who have heard her before are looking forward to another insightful, comprehensive, but also entertaining talk about the Supreme Court. Now, last week I noticed an article in the New York Times by Adam Liptak, where he referred to one of Dahlia's recent Slate articles, the title of which, "The Supreme Court is Bored Out of Its Mind." Now, let's hear why. Dahlia?
Thank you so much, Bob. Thank you to the senior statesman. This is really one of my favorite things to do every year, and thank you for having me back. And someone can actually sit in my chair because I won't be using it. So if there's someone standing at the... There's one chair if someone wants to sit at the very front and root through my purse. I'm going to try to talk about why the Supreme Court and I are having nervous breakdowns. This has been a very hard term to cover, and it's very hard to talk about something that's not happening, which is the not vote and the not confirmation on the invisible Merrick Garland. So we'll talk a little bit about that, and I'll try to leave heaps of time at the end for questions, because that's always the good part of this show. So let me... begin by wishing all of you a happy Constitution Day, which will be on Friday. Yesterday, I was speaking at Old Dominion University for their Constitution Day celebration, and when the waitress said, "Is this a party? Is this an occasion?" We said, "Yes, it's Constitution Day." And literally, she said, "Good luck with that." And I thought, well, we didn't invent it. It's a federally mandated holiday, but okay. The fact that our waitress thinks it's a punchline. So I should just give you the caveat. In fact, Friday is Constitution Day, so you should wear your Constitution hat and sing your Constitution carols. But this was, in fact, a holiday that is, with almost no disagreement from Constitution scholars, clearly an unconstitutional holiday. It was passed by, as of course, a rider to a bill in 2004, and Constitution Day requires that any educational institution that receives any federal funding must spend a day in September celebrating the Constitution, which clearly violates the 10th Amendment, but there we go. I should just tell you, so that you can celebrate Constitution Day with your friends and family on Friday, that the people who were thrown into a total panic in 2005 when this legislation was enacted was, in fact, the massage and cosmetology schools of America, who all received federal funding and didn't know what they were going to do to celebrate the Constitution. So usually I come here and I talk to you all about the term that just happened and the term that's coming and all the incredibly riveting cases that are before us. But this term and to some degree last term are, to quote the show Seinfeld, terms about nothing. I mean, they're not interesting. Doctrinally, certainly there were some blockbusters at the very end of last term, but really this is a term that's coming up. The court has only granted 29 cases. That's a record low. They've turned away incredibly important cases because they know they're going to be 4-4 for the foreseeable future. And so this is an incredibly interesting story about nothingness and a term that will be nothingness. And so I thought what I would do, instead of talking only about the cases that came before and what's coming up, I'll do a little bit of that at the end, but I thought I would talk a little bit about life after Scalia. And is there life after Scalia? It seems there is, but not much. And certainly at the court, very little. So as you probably know, the Supreme Court seat that was occupied by Antonin Scalia has been vacant since he died on February 13th of this month. That means his seat has now been empty for 212 days. And we also know that within hours of his passing, we learned by way of Twitter that that seat was not going to be filled by this president, but that the leaders of the Senate Judiciary Committee would be very certain that the seat was filled by the next president. And they've made good on that promise. There's been no hearing and no vote, and not even really, I think, a serious national conversation about whether there should be a hearing or a vote. And so when Barack Obama nominated Merrick Garland, he's the chief judge of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, to the Supreme Court on March 16th, what that means is that Judge Garland has now been waiting for 181 days for a hearing. Just by way of comparison, for people who think this gridlock is usual, Elena Kagan only waited 87 days. Chief Justice John Roberts waited 62 days. The previous record for doing nothing while nothing happened was in fact held by Louis Brandeis. He had the longest wait between nomination and confirmation, which was 125 days. But A, that was 100 years ago, and B, Judge Garland handily passed that record on July 21st. So he is now the longest waiter in Supreme Court history. Congratulations, invisible Judge Garland. Now, in case anyone is wondering, and I hope you're not anymore, but it being the week of Constitution Day, in case you're wondering whether there's some constitutional or legal mechanism to force a hearing against the will of the leadership of the Judiciary Committee, the answer is no. There are a few very interesting lawsuits that have been filed by various renegade lawyers around the country who are really, really mad. But the truth is that the advising consent clause of the Constitution is not enforceable. It's not self-enforcing. It's not enforceable by others, unfortunately. And I think pretty much across the board, scholars agree that the solution to this is a political solution. There is no legal solution to Judge Garland's woes, and in case you were hoping that this might be an issue on which some folks on the left have different opinions, I would just hasten to point you to a speech last week at Georgetown Law School when Ruth Bader Ginsburg herself said, in case you're wondering if there's anything we can do legally, no. We can't. This is not a court problem. And she said, quote, even if you could conceive of a testing lawsuit, what would the response be? You want us to vote? We'll vote no. So that's Ginsburg putting to rest any notion that this is something that could be solved by judicial fiat. So the most important thing, if you remember back to my standing right here last year, was that last term at the Supreme Court, the 2015 term, was intended to be the term of the century. And I think, if I recall correctly, as I was speaking to you, somebody in the audience said, hey, the Supreme Court just accepted the abortion case. And I was like, I gotta go and file something. And I went and filed something. That won't happen today because all of the justices are hiding somewhere. Nothing doing this term. But I cannot put enough of an emphasis on the idea that last term, had it played out with nine justices, would have been a landmark term comparable to Bush v. Gore, comparable to Roe v. Wade, because on the docket last fall, and I think, again, we talked about this at length last year, we had voting rights. We had the very principle of one person, one vote. We had the future of affirmative action. We had the future of Roe v. Wade. We had the entire question about President Obama's immigration order. We had questions about the death penalty, racially tainted jury instructions, and another challenge to Obamacare, all on the docket. And I think, if I recall correctly, I told you a lot of these cases were going to be, in my view, 5-4 for conservative outcomes. And this really looked like the term where the court reached out and took Fisher, the affirmative action case. They didn't need to. It looked like they were taking it to do away with affirmative action. The court reached out and took one person, one vote. They reached out and took a lot of cases that were not necessarily properly before the court. Some of them had been fast-tracked to the court, and it looked as though there were votes at the court to really, really make it a milestone year in terms of, I think, cementing the John Roberts Court legacy of here's what a 5-4 court can do. Needless to say, I'm still breathing. That did not happen. Most of the outcomes that we thought were going to happen did not materialize. And there are several ways that that played out. But after Justice Scalia died, and recall he died in February before a lot of these big, big cases were argued or decided, and some of them, like Fisher, were argued while he was on the bench, but then he obviously didn't participate in the final decision. But there were a few things the court did to tamp down what would have been a very dramatic term. Now, one of them was kicking cases back to the lower courts and saying, you guys figure it out. We can't do contraception mandate this year. Some of them were simply split 4-4 so that the judgment of the court below became the law, but in most cases only in the jurisdiction where that court sits. So that was kind of a fudge. And the third thing, and I think we can talk about it, but I think in some ways the most interesting thing the court did was decide a lot of cases very narrowly. So these were not blockbusters. 8-0. And they said, okay, what is the most narrow legal principle we can agree on that means close to nothing, but we could all agree on it, and let's do that 8-0. And that happened too, and I think that each of those is a sort of interesting marker of how the court dialed down the volume on what would have been a really very, very impactful term otherwise. So the question I posited when I started is there life after Scalia? And, you know, I'm here to tell you because the room in the whole month of February and March, when the chamber itself had a chair that was an empty chair swathed in black crepe, was palpably sad. And it was not a right-left thing. It was everybody was destroyed. And one of the lessons I took from last year, almost every TV and radio show I did, the first question I was asked was, and you all have asked me this question too, come on, is his best friend really Ruth Bader Ginsburg? Tell those guys, they secretly loathe each other, right? And the answer, of course, is no. And the person who was probably most destroyed over Scalia's death at the court was Justice Ginsburg. And each of the justices, including Sotomayor and Kagan, have really, I think, spoken pretty volubly this year about how broken up they were over the death of a friend and a colleague. And so I think at the most sort of essential level, it was a death at the court that has really rocked the court, and the court is still grieving. And it's just interesting to be in the chamber and see the energy gone, which was the case for, I would say, at least February and March. So the other thing that's really missing at the court right now, and you really felt it as soon as Justice Scalia left us, was that his amazing sense of humor was gone. And I know probably you think the court is not a funny place to cover, but you'd be wrong. It's in fact extremely funny. And there is a law professor who has spent several years collecting laugh lines Of each of the justices during oral argument. And Scalia was so far the winner on laugh lines that he's just stopped doing the competition anymore. I should probably caution that Ruth Bader Ginsburg, whose name keeps coming up today and will come up more, is the least funny justice every year. She is unfunny in every way. But the court really became a place that went from, you know, just that great sense of humor he had, that larger-than-life operatic way that he commanded the room. There's no one like him anymore. And you always had kind of a room full of eight wonks and a crazy person. And, you know, the crazy person, like, brought amazing joy and energy to everyone, even if you disagreed with him. And it's quite palpable that that's gone too. Former Justice Byron White used to always say, that when a new justice came on the court, it became a whole new court. I think what I learned this year is that when a justice leaves, it also becomes a whole new court, unrecognizable even to people like me who'd been covering it for 17 years. So the other interesting development that happened doctrinally is that there becomes a really interesting emboldened left wing of the court. For the first time that I can remember in my career, the justices on the left of the court sort of looked around and sniffed the air and said, hey, we could win stuff now. And they became very, very aggressive at oral argument and very aggressive in opinion writing. And you know, as you know, from the end of the term, where this was really the winningest term for the liberal wing of the court in decades, that the left wing of the court interestingly kind of pulled together. And that a lot of people, and I'm thinking of Justice Stephen Breyer, who would sort of peel off and go their own way frequently, really started to realize, you know, if we all row together, we could really now be a force. And that was a big shift. Where I saw it probably most prominently was in Whole Women's Health and the abortion case that was argued in March, which was the really, first of all, you know, I cannot, and I've said this to you before, it's so extraordinary. The court had not heard an abortion case since 2007. At that time, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was the only woman on the court. I cannot emphasize enough the difference between having three women at an oral argument about reproductive health as opposed to one. You know, and really, really, I sort of described Whole Women's Health, the argument, as just the women justices just strapped on their roller skates, and they went crazy. And I had never seen anything like it, to the point that, you know, the Chief Justice, who was mildly giving them time, you know, time's up, and literally Sonia Sotomayor at one point was like, yeah, no. And just kept talking over him. And at one point, you know, I think Justice Ginsburg felt as though one of the advocates had not been given enough time. And she literally said, Chief, you're going to give her 10 more minutes, right? Which, you know, we'd never seen before. But there was just this sense that there was, you know, moving into this vacuum was this group of women who really, really, particularly in that case, which was just a spectacularly interesting oral argument, but the sort of gender valence was inescapable. And for people like me, I think I may have told you this, but one of my favorite things to do is go back and read the transcript from Griswold versus Connecticut, and that was the case where the court initially decided about the right to contraception, and it was all male justices at the time, and they were so freaked out at talking about contraception that they did not use the words. None of the words. And so it became very clear, if you go back and you read the transcript, that has this who's on first quality of like, I'm not saying anything, I don't want to hear it, nope. And so literally, they couldn't agree on what they were not talking about. And all these years later, it's really kind of interesting to see, you know, the women on the court who are like, well, those days are over. And they really, truly were this term. So the other thing that really happens on the court is this very, very discernible split on the right wing of the court. And, you know, it's going to take a little while because there weren't enough cases to really measure. But what we did see was that Clarence Thomas and Sam Alito hiked to the right, trying really hard to occupy, I think, the space that Justice Scalia had left. And interestingly, and I don't know if it was in reaction to that, but seeing the Chief Justice, John Roberts and Anthony Kennedy, drifting to the center. And so whereas once it looked as though, I mean, not that long ago, the five then justices on the right wing of the court were much more in lockstep, this year you really saw, I think, a fissure. And what you saw, and it played out in a whole host of very, very angry dissents. Clarence Thomas wrote more dissents than any of us could remember. Alito wrote dissents more than anyone could remember. And here we see the Chief Justice, and particularly Justice Kennedy, trying, I think, very hard to signal that the court was not going to be 4-4 on partisan lines, moving to the middle and trying to find kind of consensus and to make common cause with the liberal bloc so that we didn't have the kind of splits that they were afraid would make, you know, headlines. And so really interestingly, I think the story of the term is not just that Justice Kennedy voted with the left more than he ever had, but that in several cases, John Roberts did too. And where Roberts could pull together some kind of clump in the middle, he really invariably tried to do that. And I think that's a dynamic you're going to want to watch in the coming years, because it's very intriguing and suggests to me that this narrative that we have a 5-4 court or a 4-4 court is not complete. I think that the best evidence I can give you of Justice Thomas really moving into Scalia's space was that for the first time on February 29th of this year, for the first time in 10 years, he spoke at oral argument. And it's been suggested that it was February 29th and maybe he'll only do that on leap years. But, you know, the last time he had spoken was 10 years earlier. And I happened to be in the chamber when he spoke. And it was such an extreme. It was a nothing burger case. Nobody was there. There were a handful of reporters waiting because the second case to be argued that morning was actually an interesting case. And we were all sort of sitting around flipping through our notes and doing whatever it is we do. And suddenly, and you know, the government attorney, it was a guns case, but sort of a statutory case, not a Second Amendment case. And the government attorney, who was arguing in favor of a ban on guns for domestic abusers, was so bored because no one had asked her questions that with 10 minutes to go in her argument, she said, if there are no further questions, she had nothing left to say. And she closed her binder to walk away, and suddenly you hear this great booming Clarence Thomas voice. We were all, you know, and I have a question. And we were all like, oh my God. And I thought that was it for Justice Ginsburg. I mean, it was really, he speaks, and speak he did. And he spoke for quite a long time. And, you know, there were all sorts of explanations. Afterward, the rest of the press corps had to interview those of us in the press corps who were there. That was our story that day. Was talk about when he spoke. He spoke. Talk about that. He spoke. But that was a huge story. Maybe the best evidence I can give you of this new realignment somewhere around the center is that when you look at the statistics from the end of term, which shows the agreement between any two justices, by the end of the term, we find Anthony Kennedy agreeing with Stephen Breyer 91% of the time. In 91% of the cases, they're aligned. At the end of the term, we have Anthony Kennedy agreeing with Elena Kagan 95% of the time, right? This is a sea change from what the story was that we were telling each other in this room last year. And just by way of contrast, if you look at the agreement between Chief Justice Roberts and Clarence Thomas at the end of the year, it's only 75%. It means in a quarter of the cases, he's not voting with Thomas. So I think as we go forward, thinking about whatever is going to happen going forward, I think thinking of this court as a 4-4 court is too simplistic. I think it's a sort of 4-3, you know, 1, maybe 2, but it's a complicated alignment that doesn't look the way it looked in our heads. So some of the other trends I just want to speak to because they were interesting is cases that looked from oral argument as though they were going to be 5-4, when they were argued, ended up being 8-0. So the one person, one vote case out of Texas, which really was, I think, one of those cases that everybody said, how did this even get to the court? It's really fundamentally challenging this principle of one person, one vote. And it was a very, very rocky oral argument. And it looked as though the plaintiffs in that case might have prevailed. By the time I think the court had to dispose of it without Justice Scalia, it was 8-0. I think there was just a feeling like this can come back in 10 years, but we are not the court that's going to handle this. And an Arizona redistricting case that was the same, that would have been close, except it wasn't close because there weren't the votes. Now, there were 5-4-4 splits, of which 3, I think, were incredibly consequential. And we should talk about them because, as I'm going to suggest in a moment, one of the narratives that's come out of the Scalia vacancy is maybe 4-4 splits don't matter. 5 out of 62 cases is actually quite a lot. And 3 are hugely consequential. So the first was Friedrichs, and I remember we talked about that last year. That was the financing of public sector unions, and it would have, had the plaintiffs prevailed in that case, fundamentally changed the way public sector unions in this country could finance themselves and really whether they could viably continue to operate. That was, I think, a case that was clearly going to be 5-4 for the plaintiffs, and that was 4-4. And what that means is that, and the plaintiffs in that case have actually tried to bring it back this term and been batted away by the court, but what it means is that that whole area of law is now in disarray. We just don't know going forward what that's going to be. And the one that you all know about that's really important was President Obama's immigration action. And, you know, this was a situation where we had one district court judge in Texas who put a hold on the entire deferred immigration program on DACA. And that judge was then upheld in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. So the entire program didn't go into effect. And because the court split 4-4, that injunction is still in place. That means that the program cannot be effectuated. And so this is unbelievably consequential for, you know, illegal residents of this country who really thought that their lives were going to be changed forever by this deferred action. And so this one, you know, may or may not get back to the court. I don't think it's going to get back to the court in Obama's presidency, certainly. And so what that means is that what would have been, I think, a signature executive action for him is effectively scuttled by a 4-4 court. And the third one that mattered was a question that just had to do with jurisdiction on Native American on Indian lands and who had jurisdiction when visitors committed a crime or a tort on those lands. That also gets resolved 4-4. Are we humming now? It's humming a little? Weird. Okay. So those are big, big, big deal cases, and those are issues on which the lower courts have no guidance. They just don't know what the law is, and we're going to have to wait, and that is not without significance. Now, I want to point out that the court this term heard the lowest number of cases that it has heard since 1932. Only 62 cases resolved by the court this year. And I think I said this at the beginning, has granted the lowest number of grants for the coming term, only 29. So the court is more or less kind of bumping along. And the other interesting thing that's happened is that some cases that were teed up to go to the court immediately, I think within days of Justice Scalia's death, got settled. So it was a huge Dow Chemicals challenge that was going to the court. And I think once they realized that Scalia was gone, they just paid a huge settlement to make it go away. There was a big, big guns case coming up out of New York that would have resolved a lot of the pending questions on Second Amendment litigation. They just said, you know what, we're not going to win with 4 votes. And so I think you're not only seeing the court batting away cases, but you're actually seeing litigants who are in this state of equipoise. They don't want to bring cases to the court that are either going to be 4-4 or that are not going to be resolved at all. So I guess the sort of upshot of that first thing that I said is there is a possibility, there is a story to tell, which is maybe this is a really good thing. That if you are in America who thinks that we have an imperialist court that wades into too much and does too much and can't find a social issue it doesn't want to upend, then maybe it's a good thing to have a court that's doing virtually nothing, right? And that maybe, you know, the best thing that could happen to us is to have a court that takes no cases, decides no cases, and will no longer take any cases of any import. The other slightly less fatuous version of that story is maybe it's a really good thing for a court to decide things narrowly and be a minimalist court and do things in the most narrow and non-dramatic fashion and build consensus around very, very narrow principles. And maybe that's a good thing. And I think a lot of people who've been anxious about this slightly, a court that has taken on way too much of a role in the polity are comforted by some of those stories. Now, my version is less happy. My version is that the court exists to settle disputes and to do it in a nationwide fashion and to be clear and to give guidance and not to be confused and unhappy. So it seems to me that my narrative is the court is kind of broken. It will be broken for the foreseeable future. And that's really problematic, and that's not resolved by saying, oh, we'll send this case back to the lower courts, or we'll resolve this one by not deciding anything. That seems kind of, I could do that, but it seems not a solution. So I want to tell you about the other, and I think even more disturbing from my perspective, trend. And that is that this is the biggest problem that nobody is talking about. And by that I simply mean that if there is one issue on which the justices have been virtually unanimous, it is that the scenario I just painted, the 4-4s and the non-decisions and the kicking things back to the lower courts, is okay. Everyone says it's okay, and we have statements from almost all of the justices across the spectrum saying some version of like, that's okay, we could do this, you know. So we have Sam Alito saying immediately after Justice Scalia died and he was asked, how are you going to do this 4-4 thing? And he said, you know, we'll deal with it. And then Justice Stephen Breyer saying, we'll miss him, but we'll do our work. For the most part, nothing's going to change. 4-4 cases, sure, they come along, but contrary to what a lot of people think, half of our cases are unanimous. Like, we don't even need 6 of us. We could do it with 3. We could do it with 2. I could do it alone. So there's just this sensibility that, you know, it's incredibly important institutionally for all of the justices on the court to keep saying, nothing to look at here. We are not a political institution. We are not going to insert ourselves into a fight with the Senate. And remember, very shortly after Scalia's death, Senator Grassley went after John Roberts personally, and John Roberts had done nothing, as far as I can tell, other than brush his teeth that day. But Grassley made a statement saying, you know, he's politicizing the court, and, you know, the court is really political. And this is not us politicizing the court. This is the court politicizing the court. And I think the court has deftly said nothing about this. And it will surprise you not at all when I say, shout out the name of the one justice who has loudly said 4-4 sucks. Who is that justice? Yeah, Ruth Bader Ginsburg is the only person who has sort of stumped around this summer and said, we are doing a disservice to the country when we are hobbled and when we don't say that we're hobbled. She had a statement last week where she said, when we are evenly divided, it is equivalent to denying review. There were important issues in these cases that we were unable to decide, and they will come back again and again, and one of them was the president's immigration policy. So thank you for saying that thing that nobody will say, because it's true, it's problematic. But I think you really need to understand the extent to which the court wants to stay out of this fight, and if that means that all of the justices are going to keep asserting that everything is great and they love this 4-4 thing, they will just keep saying that. And as I said, across the ideological board. So now's a good time to say, Ginsburg, what was she doing in July when she thought she would tell every reporter with a pulse how much she hated Donald Trump? She didn't tell me, by the way. I was a little hurt. But she, it wasn't like she said it once when she was drunk. Do you remember when she fell asleep at the State of the Union and then the reporter said to her, Justice Ginsburg, you fell asleep at the State of the Union? And she was like, oh, well, we were all drunk. And that was, so she's pretty honest when she drinks and talks. But this was not a drinking and talking episode. This was Ruth Bader Ginsburg telling three different reporters over the course of a week that she really, really, really hates Donald Trump. And this really was unprecedented. I've never seen anything like it. I went back and looked. I've never seen anything like it. You can certainly say it's like what Sam Alito did when when Obama was talking about Citizens United at the State of the Union, and Alito accidentally went, "That's not true," and all the cameras saw him. It's nothing like that, attacking a presidential candidate at the most practical level. Just put aside the optics of a Supreme Court justice attacking a presidential nominee, but if there is a Bush v. Gore-style case that comes up to the court in November, guess who is going to be called on to recuse because of her statement? So this actually has very serious consequences. Now I should add the coda that nobody can make a justice recuse themselves. And so I suspect that if every American stood with flaming torches and said, you must recuse," she would just fold her little skinny arms and say no, and she wouldn't. But, you know, what was she thinking? I mean, that was a really strange enterprise. And, you know, just to be completely clear, she wasn't even particularly witty about it, right? So first she tells the AP she doesn't even want to think about the possibility of a Trump presidency. And then she tells the New York Times that a Trump presidency was the sort of thing that her husband, Marty, used to say would make them move to New Zealand. It's a little bit funny. She can do better. I told you she was not the funny justice. And then when being pushed and pushed and pushed to back down, she thought she'd double down and told Joan Biskupic at CNN that Donald Trump is a big faker who makes things up as he goes along and should reveal his tax returns. So just so you know what she feels, in case you didn't know it, she just wanted the last person in America to understand she does not like Donald Trump. And Trump's response was, you know, her mind is shot and she should step down. And, you know, then she walked it back. I mean, she said, she didn't say, I shouldn't have, you know, she didn't say, I think those things are untrue. She said, I regret saying them, which is a non-apology apology. I've been on a lot of panels and a lot of interviews sort of probing what she was doing and why the person that I think is the most savvy political thinker on the court today would let herself get in that situation. And I roundly reject the she's 83 explanation. I think she is as sharp today as she was 50 years ago, so it's not that. I think for me and a few other people have suggested this strongly, it's important to understand that she was born in 1933. It's important to understand that she lived in a Brooklyn where Holocaust refugees were literally everywhere, and that that is what she was born into. And I think it's really important to understand and to take her at her word when she says, you know, her decision to become a lawyer was almost entirely fueled by the Red Scare and by just what she saw as the derangement of what it was doing to the academy and what it was doing to lawyers around her that she thought was doing good work. So I think it's, you really can't look at it sort of absent the historical context of what she's seen in her life. And for her to have this amazing political currency and cachet that she has built up, right? She's a tote bag, she's a t-shirt, she's, you know, got a crown and she's a rapper. And I think for her to parlay that into a comment on the election is not a mistake. I think she, in her mind, she felt that she had to be the person to say this. And I think the other thing that you have to understand is that it comes shortly after Judge Curiel is attacked by Donald Trump, right? This is the judge that Donald Trump says shouldn't be a judge because he's Mexican. He's not. And he shouldn't be allowed to hear any cases involving Trump because he's by definition disqualified. And I think the fact that there wasn't a real outpouring from the judicial branch of outrage about that was very scary to her. And I think she felt someone needed to kind of be the Lorax and speak for the judicial branch. And, you know, one of the privileges of being 83 in a tote bag is I think she felt like, you know what, if I'm going to blow all that currency on one thing, maybe I'll let it be this. So I actually think she regrets not at all what she said, and I think she would say it again. Okay. So this brings us to the last thing that I know you all want to ask, which is what's going to happen with this vacancy. And I'm pretty confident standing here and telling you there will be no hearing. And I'm more and more confident saying there won't even be a lame duck hearing. I think that, for reasons I'll explain in a moment, this obstruction has been almost completely costless to the Judiciary Committee, to the leadership in the Judiciary Committee. And I think if there's a lesson, it's that we could obstruct this nominee and the next one and the one after that for years, because people are not outraged. And so I think really, you know, there was some talk in the last few days. Chuck Grassley said, well, you know, if everybody wanted to do a lame duck hearing, I could get behind it. But Mitch McConnell said yesterday, there will be no lame duck hearing. We're going to just double down and double down. And if it means that Hillary Clinton, you know, gets to pick, you know, this 29-year-old, you know, alarmingly lefty, hippie, pot-smoking, you know, so be it. They're going to let that play out, but this is not a compromise that they're willing to take. And I think there's a real conversation to be had around whether Obama, you know, picking a 69-year-old, moderate, centrist, you know, lifetime judge, maybe, you know, just didn't energize the base in a way that he might have if he'd picked. I actually joked, I think, on even on Trevor Noah this year, that if he'd picked a Kardashian, she would have had a hearing. I mean, I think. And I almost want to say, as long as he picked the right Kardashian, but really? Really? I just think he picked someone who was a judge's judge and exciting to nobody, and nobody was excited. And, you know, maybe that was not the right play. I think it was, but we can talk about that in the Q&A. So then the only other question that really arises is Hillary Clinton going to pull Merrick Garland if she wins and put up that pot-smoking 29-year-old I was telling you about? And I think, and this is just me speculating, my suspicion is no. I think she's going to stick with Garland. I think that there's all sorts of courtesy reasons that it would be incredibly rude to pull him. I think she has a longstanding, they're both Chicago people, I think she has a longstanding professional history with him. And I think that he's done nothing but be a mensch his entire life and be a really great and solid and slightly boring, but, you know, very creditable jurist. And I think to, you know, push him away and give this gig to somebody shinier and younger just doesn't feel very respectful of the judicial branch. That's my sense, but I could be completely wrong. That's just, reporting suggests that that's, she very wisely has said, I'm not going to tell you now what I'm going to do, because she's a poker player. So she's just not going to tell us. So I want to kind of conclude by saying, you know, why does no one care? Which is where I started. The subtext here is welcome to my breakdown. And, you know, I was one of those people who thought this would be a voting issue and obstruction really matters and people want a functioning court and the kind of anti-institutional nihilism that makes us hate Congress and even makes us hate the presidency are, you know, the reason the court has a 42% approval rating, which is really, really high compared to Congress, is because people really want a functioning court. And turns out this was not an issue that anyone was going to get exercised about. I think there was some hope, and this was a little bit probably Obama's play when he picked Garland, was I think he was hoping that in some of the close Senate races, you know, for Kelly Ayotte, for Ron Johnson, this was going to be an issue that might lose them an election, looking like you're obstructive. I'm not sure that's happened. I think about how many times you heard the words Merrick Garland at either of the two conventions. That would be zero at both. So if you heard it, you should totally call your doctor, because his name was not invoked, not at either convention. It's so not an issue that groups that had been pouring money into election campaigns about this issue have pulled their money back, because it's and it's to the point where now Ron Johnson, who we thought might lose his seat over this, is actively campaigning on the proposition that I blocked Merrick Garland. So this has not only not become a defining issue, but I think it's actually become an issue on which the obstruction might have been the smart political play. And, you know, that's worrisome to people who, you know, take away the politics, who think about having a functioning court. If you can do this and nobody cares, you can do this forever. And we are not going to have a judicial branch. And I should just pause to note that the judicial vacancies across this country at the lower courts, the number of judicial emergencies in the district and court of appeals because of just a refusal to confirm nominees. I mean, this has been a problem going back and forth. You can talk about who started it, but this is at crisis proportions in terms of having a functioning judiciary all the way down. And I think people just don't care. It's a process problem. And partly, you know, we've got a crazy circus of an election to take all of our attention, and who, you know, my God, pitting Donald Trump against Merrick Garland. You know, I don't care either, but I think that it's something that I really do worry about. So I think I'll just end with the obvious thing, which I've said to you all before. Ruth Bader Ginsburg is 83. There are three other justices who are either 80 or about to turn 80. This next president is going to change the court forever. Likely. Or not. Likely. I should never say that to a room of older people. Those remarks go over much better when you talk to my son's middle school class. Yeah. What? Elena Kagan is 57. She's ancient. But I think that this is a really consequential election for the seating of the court, and I think we go into it already in what looks like a constitutional crisis, whatever that is. And the fact that this is a complete non-issue is a huge worry to me. And usually this is where I preview the big cases for next term, but... you know, there's a couple of interesting ones, and we can talk about them in the Q&A, but really the truth is there's some interesting business cases. There's a fantastic case that has to do with copywriting cheerleader uniforms that you should all be watching for. It's not even cheerleader uniforms. It's like the stripes and the squiggles on cheerleader uniforms. There is one really interesting church-state case that the court has granted. That may or may not be somewhat interesting. And of course, I think there is a non-trivial possibility that the voting rights cases that are bubbling up from North Carolina and Texas and Ohio, some version of that makes it to the court, and a non-trivial possibility that the bathroom bills come to the court this year. But really, by and large, what we've seen is the court, you know, the most notably, there was an incredibly important case that had to do with pharmacists with religious conscience objections to dispensing medications, and the court needs to take it. It needs to resolve it, and just declined to take it over the objections of many of the justices. So I think what you're really seeing is a term that's going to be, with a handful of exceptions, at least the first half of the term, they've granted cases through December, very, very, very quiet. And part of the quietness that I've described to you, both the ways in which the court really modulated what could have been a very, very tense term last year and has modulated what's coming in this year, is that it looks like the court isn't an issue. And that's in the court's interest, and I understand that, but it is certainly not in the interest of justice. So thank you very much. Okay, so there are microphones?
Yeah, let me say something.
Oh, yeah.
Which of us old folks wants to ask our young visitor a question? We've got two board members with microphones, and many of you know these programs are on the Charlottesville Podcast Network, and so you need to ask your question into one of the microphones. Dahlia, do you want to pick them out, or do you want me to?
No, I'm good. That's fine.
Well, okay.
I'll be here.
I'd just like to know what there is to say that the Judiciary Committee will do anything after January 20th. Why would this not just go on indefinitely?
No, I feel like that's my takeaway is that that's why I said I feel like there's been no cost. And, you know, I think the cost is we like the notion of a functioning judiciary, but if there's no pressure at all and no consequences, it's really hard to say why. And again, I think this is where the court is kind of like fueling its own demise, because I think if you have, you know, 7 of the 8 justices saying we're doing just fine, we could do this indefinitely. I think I wrote in an article once, you know, you're on a short trajectory to have Elena Kagan someday all by herself flipping a coin under her desk, right? Because, you know, it doesn't resonate. And because I think it doesn't resonate, I think there's just a feeling that, you know, why would this change in January? And certainly I think if Clinton were to put up any kind of controversial nominee, you'd see, you know, doubling down on this. So I'm not really, you know, part of me wants to say, because at some point government has to govern, but that would be hilarious.
This is kind of in that same vein. I was just listening to a session of NPR yesterday where the gentleman who just written a book talked about the fact that there is nothing in the Constitution that says how many justices there should be on the Supreme Court. So my thinking is that somewhere down the road, somebody said, well, let's have 9. But I don't know if it's entrenched in law somewhere or if this 8 could go on, like they say, forever without any consequences because it's not constitutionally bad.
It's not constitutionally required. I mean, I will say if you think back to FDR and the court packing plan, you know, it has been 9 for sufficiently long that when Roosevelt thought, maybe I could bump it up, you know, the country across the board went haywire. And so I think you can certainly say, and there is an argument that, you know, the court has historically had 5 members, the court has had 7 members, the court has had even numbers historically. But I think that 9 has become frozen in amber for a long time now. And so I, you know, again, it's very much like advise and consent. There is no lever to make this happen. But, you know, there's a lot of things in the Constitution where there's no lever to effectuate them. There's just a responsibility to effectuate them. And, you know, if the answer is going to be, well, we can do fine with 4 or 3, then that's the answer. There isn't a mechanism to change that.
What do you think would happen if we lost one member of the court and now there are 7? Would they lose some of their apathy and get back to work?
No. I think 7 is better than 8, frankly. I think
there'd be a majority somewhere.
I mean, I think in some ways an odd number is preferable. I think that we have a strange perfect storm here of factors that are going to make it more and more likely that this goes on forever. And as I said, I think when the court acquiesces to that by not taking cases and making itself smaller and smaller, it just becomes self-fulfilling. It starts to look as though maybe we don't need a court at all. You know, if all they're going to do with Zubik, you know, which was the birth control mandate case, you know, this is a case that had split the circuits. It's incredibly fraught. This was going to be Hobby Lobby 2.0. I remember standing here last year and saying, this is going to be Hobby Lobby 2.0. And what the court court did unanimously is send it back with, like, the way a magistrate judge would just be like, yeah, you guys work it out. You know, sent it back to the lower courts with no direction, almost no direction, and said, work it out. Then that becomes, it looks like, hey, maybe that's an answer. Until you sort of look at the cases in the aggregate and you say, it can't be an answer for everything to not decide. But I just, you know, I guess what I'm saying is that I think that the message that the court's giving, which is we can vaporize ourselves into nothing, is very congruent with the message that maybe this doesn't matter that much.
Well, I was wondering, in the very worst case scenario, if Trump and Putin, I mean, Trump and Pence were elected.
Do tell us how you really feel, though.
Yeah, I'm trying to hold it back, but okay. It's hard. Who or what do you think Trump might select for the Supreme Court?
Okay, that's a good question, and I want to be clear that we're nonpartisan. So you know, this is, it's actually an interesting problem, more on the right, I think, than the left. And that's because, really, you know, Trump is the first presidential nominee in a very long time who doesn't lie awake at night worrying about the composition of the courts. And probably the best evidence we have of that is when he was initially asked, who would you put up for the Supreme Court? He said, my sister. Who is, by the way, a judge, but not probably Supreme Court shortlist. And, you know, I think that the truth is that when he was asked, you know, in February, do you have that real shortlist? And he said, it's coming any day now, and it's coming any day now. And it still took months to get the list. And the list is really interesting. If you look at Trump's list of the names he put up, it was 3 women, 11 men. Everybody was white. Many of them strongly, strongly anti-choice. That seemed to be one litmus test. Many strongly anti-LGBT. That seemed to be another litmus test. Some of them had been judges for only a few months. One of the people on his list didn't know she was on his list. So this was not a list that was kind of hatched, you know, in the bowels of the Federalist Society. This was a list that was, you know, and I would add, and this is just an important coda, the people he left off the list were almost more interesting than the people on it. So the people on the list tended to be, you know, reputable district and appellate court judges from around the country. They're very young, very conservative. The people not on the list are the people that Washington insiders would have put on the list first. So, for instance, Paul Clement, who was was George W. Bush's Solicitor General, and I think probably the most brilliant attorney I've ever seen, not on the list. Brett Kavanaugh, who's on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals and widely considered, you know, the totality of the short list of D.C. insiders, also not on the list. So he was at pains to say, I'm not taking any of the D.C. insiders, not taking people who went to Ivy League schools, not taking people who practice in California or in New York the way everyone. I mean, he really, in a deep sense, democratized the selection process. Now, maybe I'm giving him too much credit. Maybe he was just flipping through a phone book. But it certainly looked as though he was trying, in a way, to say, I'm going to not take the obvious next guy. And the people who were very freaked out by that was the movement conservative establishment, who don't know who these people are for the most part. And some of them have very little paper trail. And the only other sort of coda to my caveat, to my footnote, is that when he put out his list, you may recall the last sentence said, or people like them. Which was such like a glorious piece of Trumpism. It was like, take it or leave it. This is my list today. So, you know, I think I don't know how to answer the question beyond, you know, I think that, you know, Trump one of the things that's clear about him is that, and this was, you know, why I think that movement conservatives, you know, whether it's John Yoo, you know, the author of the torture memos, who's come out and said, oh my God, you know, don't vote for this guy. I mean, I think movement conservatives are as anxious about him as you are, because I think that it's not clear to them that the values of, you know, a movement that has, you know, not only blossomed but been so successful are simply not his values. So it could be his sister.
Not being a student of Scalia and his personality, you've alluded to the fact that the 5-4 broke. Did he have some relationship with Kennedy, the two that sort of went to the center? Can you talk a little bit about...
It's a great question. I actually am not sure that it was by dint of Scalia's personality that this split started to happen, and I would be careless if I didn't say, look, John Roberts sided with the government in both of the Affordable Care Act cases. So clearly John Roberts was not, you know, in perfect alignment with Scalia and Alito and Thomas at all times. This is something, you know, that has been dislodged for at least sometimes, although when Ted Cruz would get up and say, you know who the biggest hippie in the history of Supreme Court justices is? John Roberts. And you'd just be like, wait, one case and he's dead to you? You know, but John Roberts gets held out as the biggest traitor ever. I don't think it was by dint of personality. And I would go so far as to say, and I think I even said this last year, that some of the things that Scalia was writing in dissent about Kennedy toward the end of his life were horrifying. I mean, even by Scalia standards, right? We talked about this last year when he wrote in Obergefell in the marriage equality case that Kennedy's opinion read like a fortune cookie. I mean, this was not regular Scalia trash talk. This was, you know, he was really brutal. And I think I would be willing to say that if that didn't have an effect on Kennedy to drive Kennedy actually away from the block, I would be shocked. So I don't think it was so much, you know, that Scalia was holding the right wing of the court together. And I think a lot of the obituaries said that doctrinally, you know, Scalia's story is the story of lost promise. You know, that this was somebody who came up through the political system, who seemed to have unbelievable charm and the ability to bring people together. And then he got on the court and just started insulting everyone. And that, in fact, he could have effectuated exactly the constitutional revolution he dreamed of, right? I mean, this is the man who built originalism from the ground up, and there are no originalists, maybe one left on the court. This is, you know, not a win for him. So I think probably the opposite of what you're positing is true. I think that Scalia, and it's simply because, you know, he was brilliant and he had no patience for people who didn't think he was brilliant and agree with him, that I think he drove more people away from his worldview than brought them in. So my suspicion is if this fissure that I saw this term, and it's more than a fissure. I mean, Kennedy, I think, was on the winning side of 98% of the, you know, close cases this year. I mean, Kennedy has just moved. And we can talk about, you know, the abortion case and the affirmative action case where it was most notable and probably most surprising. But I think that the real difference is that Kennedy hikes to the left dramatically, and that John Roberts is an institutionalist first and foremost, and that, like Rehnquist before him, right, Rehnquist was his hero, he clerked for Rehnquist, he would put the court first. And that's, I think, why the Affordable Care Act cases came out the way they did. And I think that that's why, if he has to choose between, you know, an outcome in a particular case and the integrity of the court and the public estimation of the court, particularly at a moment when everyone's looking at the court, he'll protect the court. And that is, by the way, exactly what Rehnquist would have done. So I think that he takes being chief very much to heart. And I suspect that is a little bit what's going on. I don't know if that's responsive, but okay.
Hi. I was really interested to hear your analysis of how important it was that there were three women on the court for the reproductive cases. But I wondered if you had seen a broader influence for having women on the court. And I also refer to a book called Broad Influence that actually the author contends it's three women that can change a traditionally all-male governmental institution.
Often Ginsburg says, and I think this is true, that three women on a board is the magic number, and that all the studies show that as long as there's one woman on a board, A, she doesn't talk, and B, if she talks, other people get credit for her ideas, right? And Ginsburg says, and she's been pretty open about this, that in the years that she was the only woman on the court, she would say something at conference, and then everyone would say, as Justice Kennedy noted, you know, like she constantly had the experience of having people, you know, kind of take credit for her ideas. So she's the first person to say, and I think that the math bears it out, and I've written a lot about this because it's interesting to me, the difference between one and three. And, you know, the story, I think I've told this to you, but I love it, so I'll share it anyway, and that is, you know, for every year that O'Connor and Ginsburg sat together on the court, at least once, but usually more often, someone would call Ginsburg O'Connor and call O'Connor Ginsburg at oral argument every year. That's a long time, to the point that one of the women's groups had T-shirts made for them that said, I'm Sandy, she's Ruth, I'm Ruth, she's Sandy. And they wore these T-shirts because it was amazing. It just doesn't happen with the male justices, or not to that extreme. And I think she now says three is different. Nobody calls me Justice Kagan anymore. And so I think there is something sort of numerical about it. And I think, and this is important, you know, I really, you know, and I haven't even fully absorbed what it was like to watch both Zubik and Whole Women's Health and have women on the bench. Because you go back and you listen to arguments in Roe and Casey, it's a really different proposition. But for me, I think the most interesting thing is how Justice Breyer comes along with them. And not only does he come along with them, but I actually think he doesn't get credit for this. But I actually think somebody sent me a T-shirt after oral argument in Whole Women's Health, and it said, Sonia, Ruth, Elena, and Steve. And the sort of, I think the subtext was that Breyer was actually devastatingly on point in that case. And I think it's, again, interesting and not an accident that Justice Kennedy, in the majority in that case, assigns it to Justice Breyer to write, right? Let me tell you, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, every morning of her life since her bat mitzvah, has woken up saying, I cannot wait to write the opinion in Whole Woman's Health. Like, this is her dream, and it gets taken away, so much so that she writes an amazing little concurrence that says, P.S., I'm here. But, you know, Breyer writes it, and I think that's almost more interesting. I mean, to me, the interesting story isn't even just that there are three women deciding a case that in some sense, you know, implicates women and has implicated women forever. It's that the fourth person, the sort of rabid feminist who writes the opinion, which is, by the way, a tremendous piece of boring workmanlike. There is not one quotable sentence. I defy you to find a quotable sentence in Justice Breyer's majority opinion in Whole Women's Health. It's just a wonky, wonky scientific opinion. And trust me, I just have this feeling that when Ruth Bader Ginsburg saw the draft, she was like, oi, 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 you know. one line, one quotable line, Steve. But it's so, to me, it's absolutely the most feminist thing that could have happened. So I don't want to be sort of magical thinking about the three women, because I think, and this is just my last, I think about this a lot, which is why my answer is long-winded, and I'm sorry. But I think Justice Ginsburg tells this incredible story. She always says, you know, change is going to happen not from the women but the men. And she always tells the story about how, you know, if there's a way of thinking about women and gender, it's highly contagious and men can get it. And like her version of the story, which I adore, and she said it to me So you have to imagine it in her like really like New York, thick New York accent. And she says, you know, there was this Family Medical Leave Act case, and it raised all these questions about, you know, the caretaking roles of mothers and staying at home. And it comes before the court, and Chief Justice Rehnquist, this is toward the very end of his career, right? This was when he was seated the most conservative justice on the court. And not only does he assign himself the opinion upholding, you know, these core ideas of the Family Medical Leave Act, but writes this painstakingly sympathetic understanding of what it is to be a single mom tasked with working and taking care of children, and it's like beautiful. And Ginsburg's version of the story is that when she had the draft opinion lying around and she showed it to her husband Marty, he hollered down the hall from his study, "Ruthie, did you write this?" Because he totally thought Ginsburg had ghostwritten it for him. And so she likes to tell that story as being sort of really emblematic of why, you know, we forget about our male allies in these things, but they're the ones who are affecting change too. And so I just think it's really, like, for me, the perfect cherry on top of Whole Women's Health was that Breyer wrote the most boring, unreadable opinion that really, really, I think, cemented reproductive rights laws in this country in ways that we haven't seen in decades. Okay. Well, that's awesome.
And it's so colorful. I want to, of course, get back to you again, but before we do that, don't leave your seat. Howard, sit down.
Oh, my God.
Our Vice President Rich DeMong is going to say two things, and then we're going to really thank Dahlia. All right.
Yeah, indeed. Just a reminder, the next meeting will be October the 17th, a Monday, so it's going to be a different date and different, so it'll still be here, but a different date than we normally have. And I want to thank Dahlia for a phenomenal presentation. I know I'm going to have to subscribe to Slate now, so I'm going to have to start reading it more religiously. So, and thank you all.
Thank you so much.